Okay, fourth podcast of Voicing Indigeneity.
You have to pick the silly name for it.
Oh yeah, the silly name.
Indigenous Jane.
Yeah, Indigenous Jane. I was saying that my post-pregnancy movie that I enjoyed. This is going to just turn, people are just going to stop listening to was G.I. Jane. I have a certain, it's talk about guilty pleasures, but I go from, my name's Angie Morrill, I'm MODOK Klamath, and I go from guilty pleasure to guilty pleasure. That's probably going to block the mic.
Let's okay. Pick up the sound.
Okay, Madel's putting away her laptop, and so go ahead and introduce yourself to you guys.
Okay, fine. Michael Lujan Bavakwa or Mingit. Chamorro from Guam. One island man. I'm a one island man.
And this is Madelsar Nirengas or Madel, and I am from Belao, the Republic of Belao, the sovereign country of Belao.
Oh, so I guess I have to clarify then. I'm from the colony of Guam, the U.S. colony of Guam. Our sovereignty lies in Washington, D.C. Palau's sovereignty is in stamps.
That's right.
But I guess, it's good that this is kind of a running joke sort of debate and fight that me and Madel always have about our different ambiguous political positions today, or the different ambiguous political positions our islands have. Madel is from a sovereign nation that has a seat at the United Nations that has ambassadors in different countries, can negotiate different trade agreements or different immigration agreements with nations and so on.
But, and the most important thing is we are one of the 40 plus coalition of the willing.
Exactly.
Very important.
On the other hand though, Palauans don't have a military except for the U.S. military. Palauans serve in the U.S. military. The Palauan educational system is
U.S. style. I never learned my history like Miguel.
And U.S. funded.
U.S. funded, federally funded. The entire educational system in Palau is U.S. funded.
And kind of the government discourse of Palau and its independence puts the United States at the center of its sovereignty. So it's kind of like a strange postmodern sovereignty. Guam, on the other hand. Oh, and so Palauans don't have U.S. citizenship, but they have a deal with the U.S.
Yes, my status is CFA-PAL, just in case you were wondering. And don't ask me what
points.
It means.
You get bonus points if you can email us and tell us what that
what
is.
What that means, because I've asked many an immigration officer, and they don't know.
We'll have to get t-shirts like MuggleNet, Indigeneity, like some cartoon of the three of us.
We should get t-shirts. That's no joke. I think we should.
Then we could.
We can.
And then
get
bonus
a picture. Points would actually mean something.
Yes.
Hey, what is the Coalition of the Willing?
Oh, boy.
You said it. Don't open a door if you don't want to go through it, Madel.
Miguel's going to explain what it is.
It's the...
Because I mentioned it out of sarcasm and
You said it was important. I just was like, oh.
It's very material for her work. So we're going to talk about our work today,
mm-hmm.
our different academic intellectual projects, theses, dissertations, etc.
The whole language is always really flexible on our podcast. Did I just snort?
Yes. Okay, and then Madel snorts.
I didn't want to leave Andy
the
one woman island.
Well, that's a friend. It's hilarious.
So Palau is kind of a curious sovereign nation, and Guam, on the other hand, is a colony, a territory. There's a number of different names which you can use to call it, but people on Guam, and not just Chamorros, but anybody on Guam, has U.S. citizenship or can get U.S. citizenship from Guam. Guam, although thousands of miles away from the United States, is subject to U.S. immigration law, so it's a port of entry for people who want to get into the United States and be naturalized there. All federal laws apply to Guam. Guam is in the U.S. postal system. It's in the U.S. Numbering system, too. So for decades, it was a long distance, a foreign call to call Guam, but now it's been integrated into the U.S. What's it called? Telephone network. And so there's all these ways Guam can have food stamps, welfare, etc. But there, so there's all these ways Guam does be a part of the United States. But then on the other hand, no one on Guam, Chamorro or otherwise, can vote for the president of the United States. Or you do vote, but then the vote doesn't get put into the number that actually elects the president. Guam has no electoral votes either. We vote a delegate to Congress who doesn't get to vote, who can just pretty much lobby and beg.
So basically they have a symbolic seat.
Yeah, so, yeah. And so we always joke about which position is better, to be like the first world colony or like the Pacific Island dependent nation, you know? Right. But so, and so since we're talking about our projects, like these are the frameworks that we're coming from. And so in our last podcast, we talked about immigration and why I know nothing about U.S. immigration history and know nothing about immigration scholarship. But that's because I was born with a U.S. passport. So when I come to the United States, the moment I hit Hawaii, I'm treated just like, according to the system, I'm treated like anybody else who has a U.S. passport. From Guam to Hawaii, though, it's a foreign flight and I have to go through immigration. But the moment I come in the United States, I can vote for wherever, I can have residency wherever. But Madel, she can't, because she's that C...
F-A-P-A-L. So in 1994, September 30th, 1994, I went to bed as on a, I think it was an F-1 visa, student visa. That's what I had to use when I resided in the U.S. or entered the U.S. But when I woke up on October 1st, 1994... I was a CFAPAL. And so I think that just goes to show how flexible citizenship is for people who are connected to the United States.
Or whose islands or whose existences are strategically important, right, to the United States.
So
who wants to talk about, so do you want to talk about your project first? Or Angie, you want to?
Oh, geez, you guys already just, you know, I mean, okay, sure. My work, I am always, like, pretty much centered in my work. I'm always talking about where I'm at and what's going on. So this is the year I get to write my master's thesis. And the plan is to have a, you know, 50 to 75 page paper. People often write longer papers, finished by sometime in April, to defend in May, and then I will be awarded a master's degree. And so I thought I was going to be writing about a couple different things that didn't really work out, partly because I couldn't really get a handle on how to do the work, because I'm being trained in such a way that I just had a lot of questions I couldn't answer. So my master's thesis is looking at answering those questions for myself. So that's why I call it my fake project, because after I answer these questions, I will be able to go on and do my real projects that involve archives and interviews and all of that regular stuff. But for this one, I'm really just reading and analyzing, pretty much looking at what Andrew Smith was saying in a speech she gave, and in the beginning of her, I think Justine Smith might have said it, she quotes her, is looking at the difference that difference makes, basically looking at indigeneity within ethnic studies. And like last year, I wrote this sort of manifesto, like, ethnic studies needs to center indigeneity, and this is why, and but the why was really nebulous, as it, I think it should be. I think it can be transformative. I think it can be generative. But in my master's thesis, I'm really looking at a few scholars and how they do center indigeneity and then what the results are of doing that. And I'm also critiquing ethnic studies. That's actually a large part of my paper, is looking at why I think ethnic studies is an important place to do this work, and then and how it hasn't been a place to do it in some ways, and why it needs to. And part of the reason I need to make this conversation is to convince. I feel like I, you know, when I sit down to defend my thesis, I am trying to convince, you know, people and in our department who I think need to hear this argument. I mean, I probably wouldn't make this argument at a different school because it wouldn't be so, it wouldn't need to be made necessarily. If I had a larger community, if we had Native faculty, so, but that's not the case. So, but I don't think it's going to limit, I don't think that it's going to limit me. Really, I think a master's thesis is, it's just a learning tool so that you can go on and write your dissertation so you know how to do research. And I am definitely, like, working through a lot of ideas. I think I'm going to learn exactly what I need to learn from doing this. It's hard for me as a busy mom and student to really do close readings and analysis, and I'm really looking forward to that because I love reading, and I feel like we go, you know, in graduate school you have, what, 3 classes a term, you have a book for each class and a handful of articles, and you're racing, you know, and you're doing as little as possible, and how is that... You know, like, I mean, stuff does accumulate, you know, you do get, but I am really looking forward to spending some time with some texts. And thinking about criticizing my own assumptions, because I think that's one of the reasons I love ethnic studies is that, you know, I'm full up with them. You know, I am a very faulty intellectual and a person, and I have a lot of wrong ideas, and so I'm going to look at those, and I'll know why I think what I think, and I'll be able to be really much more articulate than I am able to be now. So, you know, I have often got by on being quick my whole life, just being understanding things quickly and moving on. That doesn't serve me anymore at all. And so anyway, it's I know I haven't been that explicit, but I'm still really like writing the intro, and actually I've been getting up in the middle of the night when nobody will bother me, meaning my son Leroy, to write, and that leaves me a little groggy the next day. I don't know how I'm gonna work out how to do this. Maybe I'll wake up at 4 or something instead of at midnight to 3, and so I don't separate my sleep that much. I know grad students are always thinking about strategies to get the work done. So that's all I'm going to talk about for now. But really, like, everything we talk about this on this podcast, aside from specific Pacific Islander, you know, thing, is really about, it's a part of my work. So if you're listening, then you kind of know what I'm talking about.
So one thing is, I want to say that Miguel always goes last because of his male privilege.
Says the women's studies major.
Yes.
Because if I go first, it's still my male privilege.
So anyway.
Should I go in the middle then?
Just a brief sort of overview of what my current project is what I'm working on towards my dissertation. And what it is, what I'm thinking it's going to be is an ethnography of enlisted military Belawans, not here in San Diego and in Hawaii. And I'm interested in tracing their recruitment beginning in Belau, and then how or if their racialization changes from the moment they're recruited to the times that they are stationed in their respective on their respective bases. So on their bases in Hawaii, how are Bilawans racialized differently there? As opposed to, say, a military base on in San Diego, where we're on the mainland U.S., as opposed to another Pacific island like Hawaii. So that's what I'm interested in. But the questions I'm trying to get at, however, are addressing this curious phenomenon, I think, of the patriotism that many of these enlisted males and females have towards the U.S. I find it really interesting that as Bilawan citizens, we would voluntarily enlist in a colonizer's military and then sort of undertake activities or participate in activities that perhaps are similar, are being similarly done to other peoples, say in Iraq, that sort of relate or connected to our history with the United States. So I find it very interesting that Bilawan citizens enlisted in the military are extremely patriotic towards the U.S. and simultaneously continuously loyal to Belau. I don't know how they balance that, how they do it, and so my project is interested in understanding the processes in which they can, I guess, balance the contradictions there. And maybe they're not contradictions to them. Maybe they sit perfectly well with each other. But that's where my project is right now. And I'm a little bit reluctant to undertake this project because, number one, I've never done an ethnography, and I'm very uncomfortable with doing interviews. Not on just anybody, but particularly Bilawans, because of my own location and perhaps the implications of my work and who I am, my family, and things like that. And I also want, I hope that it'll be taken seriously, you know, like the interview process, because I can see that turning into a huge waste of time for a lot of people. So hopefully it works out. That's what I'm planning right now. That's 2 years down the road. And we'll see what happens.
Let's see, my project and my projected dissertation deals with sovereignty. And so I guess that's one of the things that distinguishes kind of native peoples, indigenous peoples, from minorities or those for which an ethnic studies framework sort of fits, is that indigenous peoples, it's always a struggle for some sort of sovereignty. Where is that sovereignty? And a different location for it. Because for minorities, they basically accept that there's the point of sovereignty is the same for them and whoever they're critiquing or resisting or whatever, and it's just like two more minutes.
Sorry, go ahead. Sorry.
Hey, what happened?
Nothing. Oh. we were just looking at how much time. No, everything looks fine, honey. I think, I'm sorry, I was saying that we've been on about 20 minutes.
Oh, okay.
I didn't realize what you were saying.
I was asking how much time was left before it gets caught.
I don't think it's going to.
Oh, okay. I thought you said we had 30 minutes
left. I know, but I don't know how the equipment works that well.
Okay.
I apologize.
Sorry, Miguel.
Oh, it's okay. No, don't worry.
You're a guy, it's okay.
It's not a seamless process here.
No, not at all. Okay, so for, I guess outside of academia then, a lot of my work is those struggles for sovereignty, everyday sovereignty, working with a framework that's impossible to work with, which is the United Nations and decolonization, but then also like breaking down notions of dependency and Guam is kind of economically unstable, et cetera. For my academic work, though, and for this dissertation, I want to deal with sovereignty differently. So I want to, because although very few people in the world know about Guam, the moment that they engage with Guam, there tends to be one particular discourse which will explain why there is a relationship between Guam and the United States. Outside of just a straight kind of bland historical narrative of the U.S. taking it in 1898, like, if you look at it and try to explain why there is this exceptional existence for Guam, dependency, like discourses on dependency will always kind of emerge. So it's like, well, it's an island in the Pacific, islands in the Pacific, so maybe they'll have beautiful women, but they'll basically have coconuts. So what it needs the United States to survive. There's nothing on islands. And so you can find this in just everyday discussion, or you can find it kind of formalized in academic discourse. You can find a large body of work which says that Pacific islands just are unsustainable. The only way they'll sustain themselves is on the largesse of the first world nations, their colonizers, their former colonizers, or by the people who leave and send back money to the people who live on the islands, the remittances. And so, basically, this is what structures the way people understand Guam too, if they perceive it, if it's visible to them. And so that Guam is dependent upon the United States, and the relationship exists because Guam needs the United States to survive. And so I want to definitely rethink that by kind of reversing that dependency, showing how the United States needs Guam, and also throwing into the mix sovereignty and how there is this relationship between Guam and the United States, and how sovereignty is produced through kind of the way Guam is kind of negated, doubly negated, in its relationship to the United States. So that if someone, like, for example, like, I've been collecting all these incredible quotes about when Guam is brought into discussion, into representation, but then it's kind of just ignored. So you say, like, what's it called? Like, there's this interesting, Gore Vidal in an interview once said that he was, after World War II, he had written an article about the U.S. Empire, the American Empire. And the editor for Time Magazine, had told him, the U.S. doesn't have an empire. I mean, we have Guam, but that's it. And so, in the way Guam is brought into representation, it doesn't mean anything. As if, when I talk about Guam, like, sure, it's an empire, but it doesn't mean anything. So it's like a doubly negated existence. Guam, it doesn't matter that Guam is a colony, and it doesn't matter that it doesn't matter. And so I want to connect kind of this exclusion, kind of not just a simple exclusion, but kind of an exclusion that constitutes kind of dominant meanings, and then connect how that exclusion produces American sovereignty. And I mean this both in the sense of Guam is a military base, and what it means that internationally and nationally there is no comment about Guam. So the U.S. can move as it's intending to, 8,000 Marines, 9,000 dependents, another 15,000 to 20,000 support personnel to Guam, and both nationally and internationally there's no comment. Like, it's just reported as troops moving to Guam, as if that's what Guam exists for. So in that sense, how America is produced kind of globally as a sovereign because of this, I don't want to say invisibility, but I want to say banality, because Guam just exists as this point, nothing more. But then also just everyday life. What does it mean that Guam exists without a history but can just kind of be invoked in certain ways? So like if you, because this is what I do, I collect mentions of Guam. And so you can find it referenced in every way imaginable. It's a state, it's a foreign country, it's in Latin America, it's where gay people are sent to in order to get punished, it's where cannibals live. It's like everything imaginable is used to invoke Guam. I mean, if you know the movies like Wedding Crashers and Dodgeball, they've come up with this thing where they mention Guam in every one of their movies now in a random way. And so this is like, but there's a long history of this. Johnny Carson did this for decades where, and then Jon Stewart is doing it now too, where when he was reporting on the speech that Hugo Chavez gave at the United Nations, he named a list of countries and then that were applauding, but then the moment, and so that were applauding Hugo Chavez's speech, but then the moment he said Guam, everyone stopped applauding, unsure what they were supposed to do. So he would say, like, oh, Iran, and everyone's, yeah, ooh, another country, ooh, Guam. And then they played the cricket noise to mean that, no, there's no sound and no one's applauding. And so it's just these peculiar places where Guam exists in this way that it kind of produces its own form, produces this own kind of daily sovereignty, that you have this place that that has no history and no, you know, no meaning, so therefore you can use it to say whatever you want. But that's my project, okay?
It's a very good project. So it is. He really needs to hurry up so that I can cite him. And then, you know, my project will be solid, because if I have Miguet's name in my work, I mean, I'm going to go many places.
Yeah, whatever. Whatever. Yeah.
I think we're both really hitching our wagons to his star, right?
Whatever. I'm going to work at the University of Guam. There's no star at the university. Well, no, I know. There might be a couple.
You know what? Angie, can we put links to, like, different things, right? Like,
yeah.
Like, the link. Did you ever see that Comedy Central, the Colbert report on Palau's ambassador?
Oh, you got to link that.
Yeah.
We could probably, it's probably on YouTube. We could probably embed it in the blog.
Yeah.
So people could play it and watch it. I just saw it in your office the other day. Miguel played it for me. It was hilarious.
I think that would be great.
And weird.
Yeah.
Well, I was asking you guys about, like, okay, so there is such a thing as getting a PhD in Native American Studies. I mean, you know, but Pacific Islander Studies, like, I had got some books from the library, and it's always New Zealand.
Oh, yeah.
Philippines, somewhat. So what are, so I'm curious, like, okay, and both of your guys' work is so, you know, it's from where you guys are at, you know, mm-hmm. I guess I'm curious, like, what would Pacific Islander Studies look like, you know, like, I mean, what kind of classes would you think, like, about teaching, you know, and what would you want to take? I mean, because there's just not the potential for it. I mean, like, I go to Ross, I say, okay, I want to take, I need Native American history. You know, we write something up and I do it, you know, every term pretty much. And so, but what, you know, what would that look like?
There's the Pacific Island Studies Masters. And I mean, there's some degrees where you can do it, but nothing that I would really want to go into. I mean, but one thing is, so like the University of Hawaii, for example, is like a really good place of how incredible it is when Pacific Islanders do come together and share knowledge and work together. Because it definitely, like one of me and Madel's friends, Keith, like he got hired at UCLA for their first Asian Pacific American position. He's Chamorro. But he got hired because he came out of this incredible space. And it's not just the department, but it's the space, because all Pacific Islanders from all over come to University of Hawaii because they get reduced tuition because they're Pacific Islanders. And so in these classes, you'll find people from all over the Pacific. And it's truly this kind of indigenous internationalism that, like, Nizan talks about. And by being in that space and connecting to all these people, you're connecting to all their colonizers and all their first world paternal masters and so on. And so you learn the world in this space. And it's so interesting because it's this space that's invisible everywhere else. Like, everyone else in the world would say, well, what if Pacific Islanders are parochial, local, they don't know anything about the rest of the world. But because it brings in Pacific indigenous epistemologies and then each of these histories over this, it's like a third of the globe, the Pacific. But then considering how big it is, like, it gets no
recognition
or treatment, acknowledgement, except as like these minute tiny dots. So, I mean, I would love to develop, I'm glad that department exists, and I think that if universities in the States did more to treat the Pacific like that, like, it would be incredible. Like, the international relations, like, IRPS mm-hmm. at UCSD, like, good Lord, those people profess to be Pacific scholars. They don't know anything about the Pacific. They know about Japan or China or California.
But, you know, and then they're heavily focused on the Pacific Rim, which has nothing to do really with the Pacific Islands. So, I mean, I think it's all those geographical, like, regional distinctions that put us outside of the map oftentimes. And then when we are included, it's for under broader themes like World War II in the Pacific. Or, you know, oceanography in the Pacific. I mean, you know, things like that. So, like Miguet said, I mean, we're always a dot on the a bullet point in a huge curriculum that oftentimes just glosses over what potentials we have in many discussions.
But for ethnic studies, for example, it would be so powerful if they did find a way to not just kind of bring it in as a single reading or whatever, but to like engage with it. Because if Yen Le Espiritu, me and Madel's chair, for mm-hmm. our dissertations, like she talks about making power visible, right? Talking about absence and stuff. And like, the Pacific is that. You're talking about a huge piece of the globe.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons that America is so kind of powerful is because it has kind of sovereignty, or it has privilege and rights to this huge domain, or at least part of it, because France and Britain control different areas too.
Mm-hmm.
But like Micronesia, from like